Well, I'm pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News Dr. Simon Order. Welcome, Simon.
G'day, Michael.
Now, we'd better introduce you to our audience. First, we'll tell the audience we're going to be talking about music along the way and for much of the time. But by way of introduction, you're an academic at Murdoch University here in Perth, not far from Fremantle, and you're a Fremantle person. What is it that you teach and research in, put simply?
Okay, so I'm spread over a couple of disciplines, I guess. So the main two disciplines would be sound production, music technology, and also my main research area, I guess, is community radio and advocacy for that, and research around what community radio offers for society and culture. And I've been doing that for the last 12, 13 years. But because I'm also a music producer, I've naturally tended to look at the academic side of that. So I've investigated compositional ways of composition that create or spark creativity in myself and in students, using technology, because I'm a big technology nerd, and quite proud of it. And that's one of the things that spurred me on over the years with music, is the technology and how it's grown. I just love playing with fancy big boy toys.
Now, I'm bound to ask, did you start out in your first job doing what you've just described, or did you have something more exciting or perhaps more mundane?
Oh, that's a good question. When I first left school, I did something quite mundane, as you suggest. I worked for the railway in the UK. It didn't last very long. I met a beautiful young lady who was going to be an art student. And, of course, you know, it happens. So then, of course, I wanted to be an art student. And going to art school was the thing that changed my life.
Now, where did you go to art school?
I went to art school in the southeast of England, in Bournemouth and Poole. And I studied for 4 years in design, in photography. So in the early part of my life, I was destined to be a photographer. And this is before digital photography.
So you eventually found your way into music and radio in various ways. Just briefly tell us the sequence, because we'll come back in various ways to the more detail.
Yeah, it could be a long story. So while I was at art school, I started building my own little recording studio. And before I knew it, I had two things going on, a recording studio and a photography business. I started doing that more and more in the south of England, and then eventually I moved to London to work in television as a sound engineer and a dubbing mixer, a dubbing editor in the TV post-production. Did some film post-production, and then quite naturally moved into radio, and then eventually started building radio studios, of all things. So I've sort of been moving in around this sort of technical area and this creative area.
Let me just ask you another question there. We'll get our listeners to guess at your possible age, but when you were doing those more creative, artistic things early on, who were some of the popular music heroes on the radio?
Oh, I think one of my heroes at the time would have been someone like Brian Eno.
Well, that's really interesting, because I innocently asked you that, but I wondered whether it might have been Bowie or Eno or somebody who would come through. So what sort of, when you got into sort of sound production, trying to create your own studio and all of that, what sort of equipment, remembering in answering this question that you're speaking to people who may not have the technical experience and understanding that you and others have, but what did it look like? What sort of stuff were you using?
Well, when I first started recording music, it was a four-track tape recorder. So it was like a cassette machine, but it had four channels, and we could record four things at once. and it was very primitive indeed. You'd record three things, you'd bounce them down to the one spare track, then you'd have some left, and you'd do this process of bouncing. It was very primitive indeed, but it did teach you how to record and produce music in this very special way. And anybody that's used a four-track recorder will tell you the same thing, because you have to make lots of creative decisions as you go. To technology nowadays, you don't have to do all that. You can leave all the decisions till later, because you've almost got options anxiety in technology. You've got too much stuff. It's like having the biggest white piece of paper ever.
Now, we'll jump forward, but we'll jump back again to a way of illustrating this, perhaps. You also produce your own music today, make your own music today, and you do that under the name of Liminal Drifter.
That's right.
And you can be found on the web. What's the promo for this? Where do you find it?
Oh, just if you type Liminal Drifter and Google me, I'll crop up everywhere. So, you know, the usual stores, Bandcamp, iTunes, Spotify, get my plug in.
Now, when you make your music today, what sort of equipment, what sort of technology do you use to compare it to the four track you were just talking about?
That's a really good question, make that comparison, because the first album that I produced is Liminal Drifter, which came out in 2015, almost entirely made on mobile phones. So I was doing a lot of travelling at the time with work, travelling around Europe, going to conferences. But I started to use mobile phones and later tablets like iPads to record things while I was travelling. But also, phones and tablets now have the most amazing array of music applications. Excuse me. And I was just downloading all this stuff and having fun while I was, you know, at the airport waiting for my next flight. And I started finding myself composing in all these weird places. So travelling on a plane, sitting in doctors' waiting rooms, on trains, lots of transport was going on, but also to all the places I was visiting. So most of that album was created not at home. I didn't have a studio at that point. I'd sold my studio when I moved to Australia. And then the music was eventually produced and mixed on a laptop, like a normal album. And then since then, I've actually built myself a proper studio again. And most of the stuff I do now is still only on a laptop. I don't like the baggage of a big studio anymore.
Now, we'll come back to that, but just betraying some of my own interests, past, present, or not sure about the future. But just imagine this for a minute. Someone gets used to the platters. Perhaps they listen to their parents playing them on the radiogram in the lounge. They might have even grown to love the amazing voice of Patsy Cline, and backed by some guitars and a drum. You move forward to the Beatles, which probably in many ways wasn't all that different. And then suddenly, out of all of this, and I don't know whether he is the starting point, but you've mentioned Brian Eno. Now, did something happen with music along the way? What was Brian Eno doing? Was it new? Most things are linear and connected, but can you explain to us just what started to happen in that period?
There's a few things going on in the late 70s and into the... it actually was happening in the 60s when people were beginning to build synthesizers, electronic devices that you could make sound with. So that was happening. And then especially in New York, in Chicago, they started having what we now know as house parties. And these were DJs that had started spinning records and mixing them back to back.
Now, can you just explain that to me? Because there'll be others who will say, what does that actually mean if they haven't seen it happening?
Oh, okay. So in the 70s, we had turntables that had records. And what a DJ would typically do, he would buy two versions of the same record. And he would find maybe a section of that record that he would really like. He would spin that section, and then he'd find the same section on the other record, and he'd lengthen it out. And if he wanted to, he would do something what we call beat mixing, which is matching the tempos on those two turntables. And in the early days, that was the real skill, and that's how they would mix two records together seamlessly, as though they were one track just seamlessly moving into another.
So someone's recording the one going into the other to produce the new sound? Or you're just listening to this?
Yeah, in the early days it would really be purely for dance purposes because they never wanted people to stop dancing. And out of that practice of beat mixing came scratch mixing. And scratch mixing is where you use a turntable to roll backwards and forwards on a particular sound. It could be a vocal sound, and you get that whacka whacka sound. And that was the first incarnation of what we now know as sampling. So being able to play a section of a sound or a sound from a start point with your hand, essentially. Nowadays it would be done on what we call a digital sampler, or we could play it on a keyboard, and we can sample any sound we want. So that was all happening. And then in Jamaica, at the same time, dub reggae was taking off. And dub reggae, the whole the way that dub is constructed is all about deconstructing existing music, taking things out, putting things in, using lots of special effects. So these on two sides of the Atlantic, these things were going on. And eventually you started to get house music, hip-hop, rap, all starting to merge and develop out of these various things that were going on.
Now, let me ask you in relation to that. From what you've said, but it no doubt is wider than this, what was happening in Chicago was coming out of dance music and was providing stuff for dance. Whereas, was it the same motivation in Jamaica with the dub reggae?
In Jamaica, it was what they called dance hall. It was the same motivation to make people dance. It was just a different kind of dance. And they'd have these things called sound system competitions. So sound systems would rock up on the back of trucks, and they'd have these sort of toasting competitions. So they'd play this hugely loud track, and then someone would get up on stage and what we know now is rapping. It was called toasting. And then another sound system would rock up and try and compete with them and see whether they could do a better version of that, maybe even the same song. And it became very competitive among different sound systems. And that whole deconstructing, copying and pasting idea of reusing songs then brought about dub reggae, which was cutting the songs right down to their roots, normally taking out all the vocals and playing around with them using technology and tape machines and all sorts of wacky stuff.
Now, the people who were doing that, I assume, were getting some enjoyment out of the fact that people would then dance to it. Mm. But there must presumably have been more to it. Is there some sort of intellectual or practical satisfaction or some musical satisfaction to be got from that process you've described?
I think it was the early days of what we became known as cut and paste culture. So we were borrowing things, recontextualizing them. So maybe we'd take a bass part or a piano melody from one song and we'd mix it with a bass part and piano melody from another song. And that's where remixing started to come. We take parts from one song and put them in a new song, recontextualising them. And that is where we are now with a lot of the music we hear. And that's how technology works. It's like copy and paste on a Word document. We can copy and paste music, sections of music, and we can create whole new songs, symphonies, whatever we want. We never have to actually play an instrument anymore.
well, we'll come back to not having to play an instrument anymore. But while you're there, was there some synchronicity between what was happening in this new music world and what was happening more broadly in our culture and in other areas of artistic endeavour?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've spoken about the United States and I've spoken about Jamaica, and the answer to your question leads back to Europe, actually. Because in Europe, especially in Germany, there was a futuristic movement developing. Lots of futuristic synthesizer music, and it was also happening in the UK as well. So there was beginning to become a fascination with technology and futuristic sounds, and the idea of music could be associated with science fiction, and people were starting to become a little androgynous. So it was all mixed up in that culture. So those were the three areas, I think. So the American house scene, the Jamaican reggae scene, dub scene, and the European electro scene, they're all happening at once in this sort of triangle of culture, if you like. And then something very special happened in the late 80s. Something called, a piece of technology got invented called MIDI, the Musical Instrument Digital Interface. And it enabled electronic music producers to have one keyboard and be able to play any sound from any other synthesizer. So you could have a keyboard, but then you could play a trumpet, a piano, a bass guitar, a symphony orchestra, all from one keyboard.
Sounds like my electronic keyboard upstairs.
Yeah, and it changed the face of music overnight. And it didn't just do that, it also brought together all the rhythmic elements. Because once, the other thing about MIDI was, is you could sequence it, and it became very metronomic.
When you say you can sequence it and it can be metronomic, exactly what do you mean there?
It means instead of musicians having to play all the beats in, so if you're a drummer and you're trying to play a 4/4 time signature, your kick drum is trying to hit that downbeat on every first beat. But with a sequencer, you just program it.
It does it for you.
And it hits the nail on the head every time, and it doesn't make mistakes. And
now, let me not change tack, but come here to ask another question. I mentioned the Platters and Patsy Cline, the Beatles. I mean, in those days, just limiting my own experience on the planet to the 50s, 60s and following, you had major record companies who controlled all of the music, it seems, that we got. You can tell me if that's an accurate statement when it comes to popular culture. If it is, what was the attitude, what was the involvement of these same controllers in relation to the MIDI and everything else that was going on in this house and electronic and futuristic scene?
I think they grasped hold of it very quickly, and they realised its potential for commercial gain. It was very quick. You could make music a lot quicker, a lot faster, and you didn't have to pay session musicians. I mean, I remember as a bass player, I would go out and charge union rates, and then 10 years later, I'd go in and they'd only want me for 15 minutes because they'd sample the life out of what I'd played in 15 minutes, and they could copy and paste the rest on the computer. So instead of having 2 hours of session, I get 15 minutes. So for record companies, it was really good, and they could make, you know, they could manufacture bands very quickly using technology. They didn't have to have huge bands come in. They could use computers to back the bands, and they're still doing it now to some degree. And they'd bring in, you know, singers and faces to front that technology.
What about the style of music, coming back to the broad genre of electronic music? Did something else happen there that it seems in most cases, in many cases, to take the voice out of music?
Yeah, look, I think as we move into the late 80s, early 90s, there was a backlash against the foot on the monitor of rock music, you know, that spandex, you know, long hair, that whole ego-driven movement of rock music. It's all about them. And I think dance music was a way of people that were fed up with that saying, I'd rather have, at that time it was sort of known as faceless dance music, because all they wanted to do was dance. They didn't want to worship at the altar of somebody in spandex with long hair anymore. So I think, especially for the early 90s, a lot of people started to think of dance music as a faceless thing, and it was for dancing. And then all the wonderful subgenres started to develop. And then as you move through the 90s, you start to get some of instruments coming back into dance music. The soul, the humanity starts to come back into dance music. And you get all these great collaborations between real artists and dance music producers. And we've gone way past that now. Now we're in this era of anything goes.
Well, when you say anything goes, what are some examples?
Well, I think anybody with a laptop or even a phone can make music now. But you can also very easily mix and match that with real musical talent. And I think that's a great thing. And it also empowers people. It democratizes music, if you like. So even if you're not a great musical talent, you can still be a great producer. There are a lot of people in my field, electronica, who can't sing a note. But because they're really good with technology, they can make some amazing music. And that empowers them. It empowers, children or kids that, you know, can't play violin or they can't play piano. It's great for empowering kids to love and learn about music. But it's also great for musicians because they can mix with the technology as well. So technology is very empowering. It won't make the music for you, but it's there if you want to use it. And I think now we have a great mix. In where I teach, for instance, at the university, we have a great mix of students on our sound courses. I would say 50% of them come from the DJ producer side of things, and then the other 50% are musicians. Put those kind of people together, you get some of the most amazing synergies of music and events that they put together.
Now, come back for a minute to the detail of how you produce. We'll talk about the consequences of what they've produced and how it gets shared, and in a sense, the marketability. Is it just creativity we're talking about here? But how do these things get done? You've mentioned twice in your own case with Liminal Drifter and with what you just said, that you can just use a phone and nothing too much else. How are the sounds produced in that way? And you mentioned much earlier the revolutionary effect of the synthesizer and then the things that followed it. How does that all work to produce sound in a technical way?
Okay, so there are two very distinct types of synthesizer producing sound using electronics. One is analog synthesis, using old school transistors and filters and oscillators. And then there is digital synthesis. And in your phone or your iPad, you'll have what we call digital synthesis. And it's basically noughts and ones, and they're manipulated using math and physics to create and synthesize sound. And on most apps now, on phones and iPads, there's a little mini keyboard that you can play. And I've got this great little app on my iPad that's an actual guitar, and I can strum my iPad like a guitar. It's great. There's all these great little funky things out there now that have been developed. And they just really empower people to make music.
Well, let's come back to that. You use the expression, the democratisation of music, on the basis that anyone can do it. And it must be considered a good thing if people who think, well, I can't get the hang of this guitar, or I'm not interested in that, but they can go out and record crickets making noises in the garden, or they can come in and start to make other sounds with their iPhone, their iPad, their computers. Is it entirely a good thing because there are individuals who are engaging in a creative exercise, which just has to be good for us? Or is there something more than that? Are people sharing this and without looking for people who are replacement famous rock stars, is there, in a sense, a popular music scene in relation to this new form of electronica?
It's a broad question.
Isn't it?
I'm not sure where to start. Look, I think as well as the musical technology that's changed, it's our sharing technology that's changed. You know, the internet. The internet has changed the way we live, the way we do things. I think the gatekeepers of music they've gone. They aren't there anymore.
So who were they?
They were the record companies, the major record companies, and even the smaller ones. And, you know, you had Artists and Repertoire, A&R as they were called, and they would scout for bands. And if you didn't get picked up, or you weren't playing the right vibe at the right time, you didn't have a hope. Because what could you do? You could play endless gigs, but you couldn't produce your own records because the technology, you didn't have it, you couldn't afford it, and you couldn't distribute your own music. You couldn't share it. That's all changed. We can all do everything now. I can do all of those things on my iPhone.
So let's just posit a theoretical band. Let's call them a band. I think they still do. So a group of young people get together. We'll keep it gender balanced. Two and two. And they have been to your classes and they believe in democratisation. They're creative, they're smart. They're not interested in selling their souls, if there are a few of the big record companies left, to them. And they want to make, perform live and disseminate to people who are interested to hear what they're doing, their music. How typically would they go about doing all of that? Do they create it at home in their bedroom, as I often hear on RTR-FM as I'm driving to work? Do they put it up on Bandcamp in other places that you've mentioned? Do they perform live? And can they make a living out of it?
Well, making a living is the difficult one. look, they can do all that. All of the above, as you mentioned, people can do their own recordings in their bedrooms with their laptops. There's quite a lot of skill involved, obviously. It's like a skill like anything else. And you can learn and get better at it. But there are a lot more people now with a lot cheaper technology available if you want to learn. So there is a learning curve, definitely, to the recording side of it. But whereas it would take you 10 years to save up for the smallest studio in the world 20 years ago, you can go out and buy a laptop and one microphone, you know, in the blink of an eye, and you can be recording that day. And you can produce something half decent by the end of the day. And you can have it uploaded to Bandcamp and SoundCloud the next day and share it on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, Discord, wherever, the same day. And before you know it, you can have 10,000 followers.
And hope that Lana Del Rey might mention it at one of her big concerts.
Yeah, and the other thing about distribution nowadays is also the ability to promote your stuff. I mean, originally you'd have to employ a plugger to take your stuff to all the radio stations, all the venues, all the management companies to plug you, and it would be vinyl or tapes or CDs. Now you can do it all via email.
Well, let me ask you this. Is it a very personal form of music creation to be enjoyed in your own home? You go onto Bandcamp, you hear what someone's created. We'll come back to the sort of music that's being created as well in a minute. Or is it, in fact, music that can be shared with others? Can you go to a small music place in Fremantle and hear this music being played?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. A lot of bands love to play live. There's nothing like it. And a lot of bands will spend a lot of their time, you know, doing gigs because they like going to a gig, playing in front of their friends. And to be honest, they've got an instant social life. And it's very attractive. It's a very attractive lifestyle. And there's a great scene of people. You've always got people that are interested, and it's a great thing to do. So you'll find a lot of bands will do that, but then they'll also record at home, or they might be able to find a cheaper studio.
Now, what about the style of music with modern electronic music? You hear some things that have been mixed, and there's a voice there, as I suggested earlier, but a lot of it seems to be, to use an old-fashioned expression, orchestral. Has there been some shift in contemporary music? I mean, it seems to me to almost have its roots in classical music. When I listen to Fall Freak on the radio every now and then on RTO?
I think one thing about modern music, or ever since the collapse of the traditional record industry, I think we've got a very niche, on-demand musical culture now. I think whatever you want is there. I think one of the challenges for music lovers now is the curation and gatekeeping of your own. There's like a flood of material because of this great new distribution, networks that we have. I know a lot of DJs, and they say they spend so much time, pouring through so much dross on Bandcamp and SoundCloud to get to those one or two gems that are in there, because there are no gatekeepers. They've got to be their own gatekeepers.
So what are those DJs actually doing? They're trying to identify something that they're going to use.
Yeah.
And are they going to use it in its unadulterated form, or are they going to do something with it?
Oh, generally they use it in their unadulterated form, but they might mix it with something else. So they might mix it with another tune that they found, or they might, join it together, beat mixing it. Or sometimes they'll put one on top of the other to make a new tune. And that's just the art of DJing.
What you were saying about the internet earlier, obviously, is having a collapsing, or perhaps it's not a collapsing effect, it's an invigorating effect in respect of so many things. Once we had a traditional media, the New York Times, the London Times, some papers in Australia and elsewhere in the world would moderate and filter the news that was presented to us. And it could be said they controlled what we all got to read. The ABC gives you what they give you each day on the news in Australia. But now anybody can create on the website and express their opinions and even provide their own news services. And it's both liberating, but it makes it very hard for people at times to know what's properly authenticated, I imagine. Is there something going on here? No doubt there is, from what you've said, in music in modern times. But where's it going? Do you have any sense?
Where's it going? I think we're in a good place for the consumer. The consumer doesn't have to spend a lot of money on music anymore. They can download music. If they're good, they'll pay for it. A lot of the time, they don't need to because they'll pirate it. Or they will have a streaming account somewhere like Spotify or Tidal, Deezer, and that is cheap for them. They get access to infinite amount of music for 10, 20 bucks a month, which is very good value for the consumer.
But, and you're obviously just about to qualify it, we hear a lot about what it means for the artist. Some artists have said, I'm not going to allow you to run this on Apple or other places. I mean, how does that work?
The challenge is for artists to be able to make a living from selling their music. And where we are now in the music industry, in the music economy, is it's very difficult because the returns are so small. So if I look at my streaming account, one play on Spotify might get me 0.0001 cent. So I've got to get millions of plays to earn a living. And the same is true for bigger artists as well. So what we're finding now in the music economy is that bands and artists are finding other ways to make money, essentially. And one of the main ways for the last 10 years has been touring, because they can make a living out of touring. It's very tiring, obviously. But the other thing they can do is they can sell merchandise when they tour. And that's another way that artists can leverage their brand, is that they can have an online merch store. So that's where we are at the moment. It's a very difficult situation to make a living as a musician. Even at the mid-level, you've got to be super popular to make a living.
So that still, by the sound of it, entails the old-fashioned mechanisms of promoters and stadiums and all of the infrastructure that goes, playing like Ed Sheeran did in Perth recently to 60,000 people. If you're not in that tiny percentage at the top of a large industry, how do you do it?
You've got to find other ways. Some musicians make a reasonable living gigging by the fact of the quality of their music and the fact that they're prepared to travel a lot and work hard. A way that I've been looking at and sort of playing around with lately is doing a lot of collaborations. So it becomes a bit of a numbers game. So the more music you can put out there, the more of those trickle incomes that you get from streaming and the stores, it all adds up. So one way to do that is to do lots of collaborations, lots of remixes. One thing I'm very keen on is what we call synchronization, so making music for film and television. So this will make you laugh. I've recently sold some Liminal Drifter music to a US cooking show. And this chap, Rudy Maxa, his name is, he travels the world. It's a great show. I love it. Sampling the delights of the world. And I think some of my music is on his Bangkok adventure.
Well, we'll look out for that. But, Simon, it's the perfect segue to come back to Liminal Drifter. Now, you mentioned earlier, was it about 2015?
The first album.
The first album, 2015. How many have you had now?
I've done two, and I've got another one coming out in June.
And so tell us again the names.
So the first one was Troubled Mystic. The second one was a remix album called The Night Train Vacancies. And the one that's coming out in June of this year, 2018, is called The Dreams.
Now, tell us in a concise way that shows the development from one to the other, both in technical prowess or what creatively you were doing and what you're trying to do for the people who listen to this music.
Okay, so the way that I try and explain inspiration and the whys and wherefores of making music, I try and do it around what has been happening in my life, because what happens in my life tends to impact the music I make. So Troubled Mystic, it's a bit autobiographical. I was in the last few years of finishing my PhD. And anyone that's done a PhD will know the emotional trauma you put yourself through. And I was using it as more therapy than anything while I wasn't writing the PhD. I wanted some creative outlet. And I hadn't written music for 10 years because I'd been studying for so long. So I started writing again, and started to think, oh, yeah, I remember I can do this. I should carry on doing this. And I started sending a few tracks to a record company that I quite respected. And he kept writing back saying, yeah, I like this. Keep sending me stuff. And then about 2 or 3 years later, he said, oh, we should do something. And then we formed a partnership and we agreed to release the first album. And that was the album that was very much written on travelling around the world on phones and tablets. The second one was a community-based project, partly where I work and partly with collaborators on the label around the world. What I wanted to do was take the tunes off that first album and give them to other people and send them on journeys of their own and say, OK, look, these songs have come out of my journeys. Now I'm going to take these songs and send these songs to you. I want you to take them on new journeys. And then they sent me back remixes of that album. And it was released as a remix compilation. There were some students that I mentor. There were some staff that I work with. And there were various collaborators around the world. And we remixed, I think, almost every track on the album. And that was a really popular album. It made number 13 in the North American and Canadian electronic charts. It was fantastic. Never expected to have that achievement. And we've had all sorts of successes on both the albums, and I won't go through the endless plugging, otherwise it will become my biography. So from there, the new album, The Dreams, which is coming out in June, is a completely different... It's a departure. It's very much about Fremantle. It's about living near the sea. It's very much about swimming, the beach, fish. It's got a very aquatic tinge to it.
And in each case, these albums entirely sounds?
The first album was a combination of sounds that I recorded from the soundscape in the world and a combination of sounds from synthesizers and samples that I'd found either on phones or synthesizers. The second album, I have no idea. The collaborators did it all. My remixers did it all. And I can't guess where they found all the sounds. They took some of my source sounds and they reinterpreted them in their own way. The last album...
The new one?
Yeah, it's a secret. You have to wait.
Now, relevant to that proposition, but also the two earlier albums... when they're launched, and you did it through a company that specialises in electronic music?
Not exactly. I mean, I'm signed to a label called Hidden Shoal, who they're based in Australia, but they're a global label. They're an independent label, a very large independent label, and their name kind of gives it away, Hidden Shoal, i.e. this Hidden Shoal of artists. Very much based around, I suppose, one of the manager lives down in Rockingham. So it's that whole Shoal thing, Coral and all that. They do electronic music, but I'm probably one of the main, slightly more mainstream than some of their artists. A lot of their artists are quite experimental. I think that's how I got in, actually, using all the tablets and the phones to begin with, because they really like that. That's quite experimental.
Now, was it the second? Or, sorry, I've lost the track. The one that hit 13.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, that's a weird one, because what we did was, when we released the second album in the States, we released it as a double album. So we released the original album with the remix album as a double album package. Because I hadn't done a proper release in the States in 2015. I'd only really released it here in Australia. So the American promo company that we were working with said, oh, this is great, why don't we release both of them? And it did really well, because they could hear the original tracks and they got the remix tracks.
Now, how do you get the music played, say, in North America, Canada, and where is it played? How is it being accessed by a listener?
Oh, well, I'm a big radio person, obviously, so I spend a lot of my time promoting to radio. Me, personally, the artist, I don't have... I have a promo company in the States, and they do help me, but a lot of the work I do myself, and I'm often on the phone to radio stations going, oh, have you got my CD? What did you think? Should we do an interview? So I do a lot of that myself. So it goes out on radio, obviously, and then it goes to all the other usual places, all the stores, so Bandcamp, iTunes, Amazon, Google. Wherever you can buy or stream music, you'll find Liminal Drifter. And my biggest, the biggest economy for independent music, or the currency of it, is social media. And if I didn't participate in social media, I probably wouldn't have any name at all. And that can be quite challenging at times because I don't want to spend all my life on social media, but I need to spend enough time on there to talk to people, talk to fans, to find out, you know, what people like. Like, for instance, recently I've discovered that a lot of people really want some T-shirts because they love the designs on my artwork. And without social media, I would have never known. So I've started...
You've got your own merch store.
I'm building it. It's coming.
Now, are there centres of excellence? Are there places in the world where what you are doing... is you know, the genre or the place to go?
It's funny you should say this because I've been having to summarise all this lately for something else at work, and my genre is loosely described as ambient electronica. It's kind of chill music. It's really laid back. It's a bit quirky, a bit dark in places, but it's generally chill out. So most countries have some kind of chill-out radio station. So here in Australia, we have SBS Chill, and one of my tracks made number 10 in the top 100 chillest tracks of all time in 2016. And I got some more tracks with them through the remix album. In the UK, there's a station called UK Chill, and they have taken some of my music recently. So those are the places where my genre, where you'd expect to find it.
You often hear, at least I do, from various sources, that Berlin is the centre of all things. I don't know, I'm not sure, chilled or otherwise. Is there something happening there?
I honestly don't know. Not really. I spent a bit of time in Hamburg. I remember it. It's quite a funny story. I wasn't making music at the time, but I was doing a lot of engineering, and I got invited to work at a porno studio as their music editor. But I don't remember it being particularly chilled. I didn't take the job either. I thought it was a bit weird, but...
All right. Now, at a personal level, what is it that drives you to make the music? The ambient electronica music. What is it that obviously causes you to love it and want to make it? Can you, have you sort of searched your soul and your mind about that?
Yeah. The recent album that no one's heard yet, The Dreams, I'd say I'm not sure which is the real world, whether this world we're sitting in now doing this interview is the real world, or whether the dream world is the real world.
Well, I can't help you there, Simon, because I'm not sure either.
So this album plays a lot on that, in that I really wanted to explore what I experience when I'm asleep.
So are the sounds we're going to hear beautiful?
Mm. Yeah, I think that's one thing I really strive for. The last album, The Night Train Vacancies, the music director at RTR-FM was very, very nice to me. He said, oh, Simon, you make lush electronica. And actually, I think this album, The Dreams, that's coming out soon, I would agree to that. I think he overhyped me in the middle album. But this one, I think it really is lush. And I think I almost took what he said on board and said, right, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want it to be lush. I want it to roll over me like waves, as though I'm lying on the beach or just, you know, sitting in the sand.
Now, we should bring this interview to an end, but can we do it by being clear about just when Dreams will be coming out? Are you doing a launch? How will we all find out that it's there, so we can go in and listen, having heard you talk about it?
Okay, so the single, which is still under wraps at the moment, will be out the 9th of May, and the radio stations will have that and the whole album. But the whole album won't be out, well, it will be out, I'll be positive, in the active. It will be out about the 7th of June.
And if our listeners go on to what, Bandcamp or best place to go and look?
Most people buy music from Liminal Drifter on Bandcamp purely because the price is cheaper. But some people who are iPhone people, will always buy my stuff on iTunes.
And people who listen to RTRFM might discover it's the feature album of the week.
Well, that's very possible. The last one was, and I'm hoping that we achieve something similar this time.
Well, Simon, thank you very much for speaking about these various topics. Your background, obviously, is varied as well. Before we go, you must tell us, although, what was your PhD dissertation on? What was it entitled?
Community Radio in Western Australia, Notions of Value.
And we should finish on a community radio note, an area we didn't get to explore, but which I did want to touch upon. Community radio presumably is important to the dissemination of the sort of electronic music that we've been speaking of.
Yeah, without the community radio network here in Australia and many countries, independent artists in general wouldn't get a look in. Here in Australia especially, commercial radio will not touch independent artists. Not quite the same in the UK and the States. They're a little bit more open to it. But without community radio, we would be in a hell of a state. And it's not just for music, but it's for all kinds of arts.
So radio isn't dead, the podcast's alive, and we'll continue to listen to electronic for some time to come.
Definitely, definitely. And I hope you enjoy the album when it comes out.
Thanks very much, Simon. Good luck with it.
Thank you.